What I see, and I think this is probably a sort of common currency these days, is that there is a bit of a race to get the sort of Christmas tree baubles on the tree, by which, and I'm guilty of this, MBA at Stanford, or the attachment to the CMO's office, or whatever it is, and all that's important and fantastic experience. But I do think it's important, just to continue the analogy, to just take the baubles off the Christmas tree and have a look at the Christmas tree itself. What's under there? What is the basic substrate you've got here with you? Because the baubles are important, but they are that they're add-ons. You need to see what the substance is and try and be true to that as you go forwards, I think.
Welcome to a new special series of episodes that we've launched in partnership with the Faculty of Public Health. This series will aim to explore one key question: what is public health? It may seem like a simple question, but public health is no single thing. The series aims to shine a light on a huge range of work delivered by the diverse public health workforce as we talk to key figures in public health from across the UK and explore this question, as well as what inspired them to go into their career and what they think are the key challenges lying ahead. My name is Josh Hawkins and I'm a public health registrar. And today I welcome Jennifer Dixon, Chief Executive of the Health Foundation, a leading independent foundation committed to bringing about better health and healthcare for people in the UK. Jennifer trained and practiced in medicine before moving into health policy, where prior to the Health Foundation, she was Chief Executive of the Nuffield Trust, and prior to that, Director of Policy at the King's Fund. She has served on boards of organisations including the UK Health Security Agency, the Healthcare Commission, the Care Quality Commission and others, and in 2013 was awarded a CBE for services to public health. Jennifer, hi. Really good to have you with us today.
Very pleased, Josh. Look forward to the discussion.
Thank you. So, do you mind if we start by exploring a little bit in a day of the life of, please?
Yeah, now this is a tricky one because it's so varied, I would have to say. And my job, I really do think I've probably got the best job in Britain, leading the Health Foundation, because so many things influence health, as we know, and we'll get on to when we talk about trying to define public health. So to give a flavour, some days I'm working on economic inactivity in Barnsley. Other days it's the Cancer Research UK strategy. Other times it's looking at inequalities in health in the Northeast. Others is the future of the NHS and technological advance and how to regulate AI. So there's a whole variety of things that I now sort of have to be across. And the older I get, and obviously the more experience you have, the more knowledge you develop. So you can begin to join dots and try to see a signal amongst all this noise. But I think it feels a great privilege to have been around for so long and to be able to see these patterns, which means that what might have bamboozled me by variety 20 years ago now just seems okay to manage and sort of extract the juice for what is the most relevant thing to health. Then there are just so many factors that are important. It's important to clock those, understand the most important ones and where you can politically act, but also not get lost in the noise or weeds. So a short answer is that the typical day is very varied. And then, of course, there's managing the foundation itself, which is we've had 250 people and significant grants, portfolios and research going on in-house. So all of that takes time. So I've got a very good top team to have built. So a combination of internal and external and indeed sometimes international work is part of my normal goings on, I would say.
You mentioned the art of joining those dots, seeing the patterns. Is that how you see sort of a public health career in policy, understanding those patterns and those roles and joining the dots? Or is that more just at the level that you're working at, and how else did it change as you're going through?
I think it's more the level I'm at, but I would say it's more fundamental than that. I mean, I started life, as many people in public health do, in medicine, or at least a very technical sort of subject. And you really have to sort of know the detail and know your stuff. But as time went on, I'm the kind of person who likes to see, I like to present it with a whole lot of noise and for me to figure out what the signals are in that noise. And I think that's a kind of strategic nous that you kind of understand whether you have or not as you go through time. Running an organization like mine, you're not just a manager, of course. That is an important part of the job, but really it's strategic intelligence and nous. What's important, what isn't, what's going on, how do you pick out the most important thing, what's the vision, is something that's very important at this level. And it will be true of many people in these types of role or senior roles, I would say, to have some kind of strategic intelligence, because stuff comes at you the whole time. And if you just swim in lane in your technical work, which is quite possible, you might be a chief science officer, for example, you need to know your stuff. But as if you're leading an organization or operating on a bigger canvas, if you don't sort of clock the extra currents, this wider terrain, you can be quite frankly ambushed, and it's a risk. So as well as you might not be as effective as you need to as well. So I think I've kind of selected myself into this type of job where the you come into the job with a role, with a mission, but actually in my world, there's a kind of a blank sheet of paper, more or less, for you to then write on a script that you think is the most intelligent for this organization. So to have freedom to do that is something I've always sought for, simply because I'm aware of this kind of facility that I have. And I obviously don't have other facilities, but this is the one that I kind of have dined out on more than anything, I would say.
Some of those key challenges that you need to be able to address, not just swimming in lane, perhaps we'll come back to. If we start with the initial question. So public health is, as a career, as an idea, as many things to many people. What does it mean to you?
Josh, I think this is the most difficult one. What is public health? And 40 years on, I would say that it's still a question. I mean, I think the broad answer is that anything that advances health and mitigates the risk of ill health is something that I would probably include in that. And so that obviously spans a multitude of areas, from healthcare to managing the risk factors, turning to the wider determinants, including the commercial determinants of health. And even that can go global, can't it? So I think there's a variety of things there, both in relation to non-communicable disease, mental health, and also communicable disease. And so that really is a broad canvas. You can be right in the weeds in specific areas of risk factors or wider determinants or healthcare, or you can be operating at a different level where you're trying to bring all those things together to, I don't know, for example, work with coalitions to act on with investors on the commercial determinants. That's a really sort of way off example.
I appreciate you saying sending that your way. It's a difficult and broad question, and it can mean so many things to so many people, at the start, middle, or end of your career as well. It can change, and I think that the key priority of the series is just to showcase some of that diversity. And I think you're a wonderful person to lead off with this about the breadth of questions and issues, determinants that you consider day to day, like you say, working with industry and investors, or working politically, advocating, working with research and academia, to covering so many different aspects. The career, you mentioned medical work previously, and the change as it is into public health, it can be seen as quite a hard change by some people. I've gone through that change myself from clinical medicine into public health. But equally, it's using a lot of the same training and the same theory and the same drive that a lot of us went into medicine for in the first place. So what attracted you to a career in public health?
Yes, I mean, so yes, I started off in medicine, and I did 5 years of medicine, pediatric medicine, actually. And what I found there was that I really enjoyed the medicine, and the more technical it got. I was doing pediatric cardiology and neonates by the end, so that was quite highly specialized. That was fascinating, but I was quite aware in my late 20s of more things that I wanted to work on. So I thought, and this is quite common, I get approached by quite a few medics in their late 20s, early 30s, who are just groping around trying to think about what to do. Is there something more to clinical medicine? What else could they combine with it? And thankfully, there are lots of more opportunities then now than there were then. So I decided that what I would do is to just take a step out of clinical medicine And it wouldn't necessarily be permanent, but it would just be to expose myself to more things, to work out what kind of animal I was and whether or not there were other things. Because if you're in medicine, as you know, it takes so much out of you. You don't really have time to think about or try anything else. So I entered public health training and did an MSc at the London School of Hygiene. And that exposed me to all sorts of things, from communicable disease to epidemiology. Everyone listening will probably be very familiar. And it soon became obvious I was much more interested in policy and economics than I was in anything else. So then what I did effectively was then, after the MSc, took a year in the States as a Harkness Fellow, studied American health policy. Why were there so many uninsured? Why could the US political system not deliver that? Universal health care. And then after that, that was an eye-opener that really set me on the train away from clinical medicine and into policy. And then I effectively did a PhD, but continued my public health training and ended up working at the King's Fund after a few, you know, publications in the BMJ. I caught their notice and then entered the policy department at the King's Fund. And then from there, it was a short step to Nuffield and to the Health Foundation, I would say, but also spending a couple of years as the policy advisor to the chief executive of the NHS. I really feel that I did manage to sort myself into a groove that suited me and what I can contribute more, and would have been able to pursue that. I mean, it's been a very, very fortunate, and I feel utterly privileged to have done that. Same time, still linked with the public health community, but not working in traditional public health jobs, I would say.
You've mentioned the desire, you know, that you've seen in other people who have come to you as well for finding something more. You know, there must be more to medicine, or trying to achieve more. And I think it parallels thoughts I had as well coming in, being in clinic and wanting to do more in a way that you can't do within the constraints sometimes of clinical medicine and what you can offer with treatment and with allied healthcare services. I mean, it certainly sounds like you found some of that breadth coming into public health. You mentioned that the slightly non-traditional, even non-traditional public health route that you've taken through Harkness and policy and similar. Did you find it was accessible to find your niche within public health? It's certainly something that I've found as you come in, you're straight away aware of this breadth that you can go into. Is that something that you saw and enjoyed coming into it?
Yes, I mean, I was lucky. I kind of saw it quite quickly. What kind of, and it's not a surprise because, you know, in terms of policy and economics, I when I was at university, I was active in the student union politics, and I wrote quite a bit. So I kind of knew that there was this strand. What I wasn't quite convinced of is whether there was some way of combining that with medicine to promote health. And I could soon then see that it was possible I wouldn't say via public health training. That was very important and very useful, valuable. But actually, I think what public health did for me, public health training, capital P, capital H, was to show me, give me a platform from which I could then find the real route.
Absolutely. And I think the faculty that obviously we're partnering with here will appreciate the shout out. But I would agree, it is a good, very good training program for the grounding and the theory and for enabling people to find their way. And particularly, you know, as you're describing, the sort of person that's coming into the training program wanting to make a difference and wanting to do more and find their niche. I think it is very well set up for that, which is a boon, isn't it?
It's really set up, and the opportunities now to take some time out of the training system, to join various you know, private offices or leadership, is absolutely phenomenal compared to when I was, you know, flattering around trying to piece together you know, a kind of future. There wasn't very much around. You just had to make it up, quite frankly. And for me, just the space to be in America for a whole year with a blank sheet of paper, effectively, and then the PhD afterwards, really did help me to sort myself out. So you've really got to try to find something that really tries to touch as many buttons as possible for it to become manageable and enjoyable. So I think don't close yourself down too early is what I'd say. Keep things open, try and take opportunities, and try and reflect quite a bit that to make sure what kind of animal you are, that you've sorted yourself into the right kind of groove before you really go for it, which you need to in order to advance if that's what you want to do.
I think that's fair, and it harks back to that aspect of not just swimming in your lane you mentioned earlier. So we can sometimes feel in any career, let alone medicine, I think you get on a treadmill, you're looking at next steps and promotions and similar, and public health, you know, can seem like that substantial change. But it's that reminder that we have a long career ahead and there are a wealth of opportunities.
It's true. And the other thing is not to say otherwise, but that there are some people who really, really just want to swim in lane. They really want to be the best HIV specialist. They really want to be the best, you know, genomic mapper of pathogens, or, you know, whatever it is. And that's completely and utterly fine. I think the main thing is just to make sure that if you're doing that, that you aren't secretly somebody else that really wants to get out, that you try and find that out as early as you can.
That's a good reminder. And you mentioned the worth for you of the Harkness Fellowship, and then subsequently the PhD in terms of seeing that opportunity, seeing that breadth, going to America, understanding how things work over there and drawing lessons from there. You now, am I right, you're involved in the Harkness Fellowship subsequent to that. So I suppose, is that part of, you know, maybe wanting to give back and carry on that tradition a bit as well?
Yeah, you really do want to give back, and you want to sort of make sure that there's a really good pipeline of people coming up, and there's a lot to impart. So yes, I'm very grateful to be able to co-fund the Harkness Fellowship program with the Commonwealth Fund of New York. So we select every year and 4 candidates and send them out, which is great for a whole year. But we also fund and founded something else, which is going in the other direction, a European fellowship called Siana, which takes mid-career professionals, leaders actually, you don't go and live in Europe, but you have 4 sort of long sessions in Salzburg with 6 Brits, 6 Germans, 6 Swiss people to be exposed to a whole variety of leadership issues and you know, issues in health and care. And so that's another example. And plus, I try and mentor a few people where time permits. So all of that, it's probably not enough, but I'm, you know, I hope to do more as I advance and get older.
No, that's really good to hear. Thank you. Well, I did just want to briefly ask about the Harkness Fellowship. I think a lot of people will be very interested in it. What did you cover for your Harkness Fellowship?
Yes, it really is the most fantastic program. Please think about it. So it's a year in the States. You're situated in a usually a university. You have a mentor and you write the script for what you want to look at for the whole year. And then within the year, there are these seminars where you can discuss wider issues which are beyond your project to do with, for example, wider, you know, how healthcare is organized in America. What are the issues? Why is it as it is? How you can make change and what blockchain is, things like that, as well as health. So what I did, I was just absolutely intrigued why such an impressive nation can have 30 million odd people uninsured. How come? You know, how did they not sort of, how did they miss the boat when it came to trying to enact universal healthcare as many European systems did, and indeed Canada did? So I basically, that was my study, and I went around interviewing all sorts of people, policymakers, federal, local, state, and under, you know, tried to get under the bonnet of the healthcare system as well. My conclusion, which was that the social justice thermostat in the US is set too cold. They need to turn up the heat a bit, but well, Europeans would say that, the Americans would say that ours is too warm, but the concept of social justice and the safety net is just very different in the US, you know, which was a hard bullet to bite, but nevertheless, that was the primary reason why they didn't sort of go the whole hog in the 60s to have universal healthcare. But, you know, things change and the costs of care are absolutely astronomical out there and affecting jobs, the economy, everything, as well as, you know, having malign effects on the economy. So I think I'm not losing hope out there, although the current political situation, you know, gives you cause for worry. So anyway, so it was, you could see it's a very broad thing to try and get your head round. But I really, really learned masses and endlessly grateful for the opportunity.
Thinking about the one of the more pithy responses to the question of what is public health that I'm going to misappropriate, but it was Public health is the science of social justice, which I think is it speaks to what you're saying about a leading undercurrent of some of the work we do.
Yes, social justice is definitely a part of public health. Public health is a part of social justice, I would say, and as is health. So I think that's a fair description, pithy description.
We discussed covering, if that's okay. So what public health challenge do you think we're not talking about enough, and why?
Goodness knows there's enough public health challenges, aren't there? I mean, the one that I think that I'm not sure we're truly facing into is the apparent rise of mental distress, both in teens, which I know quite a lot has been written about, but also if you look at the figures of the number of working age people who are economically inactive, 2.6 million in the country, which is a phenomenal amount. Depression, anxiety is a large part of that. And then also for those who are economically active, there's probably millions who are economically underactive because of some aspect of mental ill health. I know we've had forays into social media and the impact of that, and that's very important. But it's this wider issue with the working age population as well. And for me, it kind of links to also our blind spot about social capital in the country, and how do we measure that and associate and think about that as a valuable capital for our prosperity. I was looking the other day at some teen mental health figures and the phenomenal rates there are in teenage girls, in particular 15 to 19 year olds, but also how socially patterned those are by deprivation, which we would expect. But also there seems to be a protective effect of ethnicity, particularly Asian ethnicity, South Asian. And you know, why is that? Is that because of social capital that's protecting these communities against a more nuclear blasted sort of white working class community? I don't know. And I really do think that we have to get much more on top of this. If we want our country to flourish, if we want the economy to flourish, even if you only care about that. So I think this is quite a big issue, and it's underlying a lot of the social inequalities and health inequalities literature as well. The concept of social capital is may seem to the hard science community or a political community quite a fluffy concept, but it's really, really important, and it's probably leading to all sorts of issues across the country. Not just to do with health, but also to, you know, voter rage and other stuff as communities disintegrate in some parts of the country. So I think that's a really, really interesting area. And I've been looking at some of this in the Northeast, where the health fabric has frayed the most in the country. So that's why it's uppermost in my mind. But the idea of being able to link directly social capital with ill health is quite hard, isn't it? I mean, it's a dynamic system. And I think there is room for judgment. And I guess this is where the public health community could be useful, where on this and other wider determinants, to develop a consensus and solid judgment to say, well, there isn't an RCT on this, there isn't hard observational evidence perhaps, but in our judgment, knowing these communities, this is what we believe. And this is our professional judgment, and that should hold sway. I don't think we should be weakened by that. So I think there is something about our confidence as a community to step up and say things like this, if we truly believe them, as I say. Otherwise, we're just completely hamstrung by evidence, which is going to run out quite quickly on some of the most important things that we can influence.
Can you tell us a little bit about research or engagement the Health Foundation are doing in this space? I know fairly recently, the Health Foundation podcast that you present, you recently had Kevin Fenton and Janelle DeGrucci on with you, and you spoke about a recent Health Foundation piece of research where a bit more linked into, I suppose, the major condition strategy and the state of the health of the nation. About, I think it's by 2040, one in five people will be living with a major condition. And within the major condition strategy in the UK, we've combined a lot of these conditions such as mental health and physical health, trying to assimilate them into the understanding that people are dealing with multiple pressures, multiple conditions, and it's all part of a wider context. I suppose with a view of trying to appreciate some of that complexity. What current work are the Health Foundation doing to try and advance the evidence base and maybe advance some recommendations there?
Yes. So I think just on that report for a minute. So what we've been doing at the Foundation, amongst many other things, is to try to project forwards the morbidity load in the population to 2040. And also to project forwards what are the, for the health service, what are the resources that it needs, what is the workforce that it needs, in what's the capital that it needs to respond to that morbidity load. And the basic story there is, so 80% of the morbidity, huge increase we will see over the next time to 2040, is because of the aging of the population. So we have to find ways, unless we're going to bankrupt our health system, of managing chronic disease, multiple diseases, better and more cheaply. So I think that's and in a more integrated and coordinated way. So that's the point one. And you know, time is short to try to figure that out. And I think that's the approach that Chris and colleagues are, Janelle, are using in the approach there. Their major condition strategy, which will be, I understand, will be published later this year, to how best to deal with the illness that's appeared. But of course, there's also the risk factors that lead to those conditions. And is there anything we can do? So there, again, we do work on not just demonstrating this mountain of ill health, but also how could we be more muscular and robust in tackling the risk factors? So what can national government do? But importantly, if national government won't act for political reasons, perhaps, or for other reasons, what can local government do? What can businesses do? What can investors do to try to reduce the risk factors that will lead to this mountain? And then so we're doing work on that. And then the other thing with local government as well, by the way. And then the other thing, of course, is wider than that, is the wider determinants. And that's where you get it's much more difficult because the evidence base is weaker. We are constantly doing research on these things. We're constantly trying to put forward solutions to try to raise the profile of these issues in local government for them to help understand their agency and how they might measure their impact. So that's the kind of terrain we're on. And we have a big portfolio of practical programs and research to support all of that. And the most recent thing we're about to publish is when do targets work? If you're going to have a cross-government strategy to improve the wider health, as we had in the 2000s, what should it look like? How would the government departments work together for a long-term strategy? And indeed, what sort of targets would they work? What sort of metrics? So that's the kind of thing we're working on all of the time, and our website and publications are full of this kind of material on the health side. That's quite apart from the NHS side. So that's quite a long, but there is quite a lot we can do. It's a question of will, really. It's the will and, you know, ideology to an extent. Do you believe the state has a role in this area in mitigating risks, or don't you? And to what extent? So, but there's a lot that can be done. And that's pretty well evidenced, actually.
I look forward to the report you mentioned on targets. And I think these are all important questions that otherwise may not be asked, or at least not asked as rigorously. So, yeah, important work. Thank you.
I mean, the other thing I must just sneak in here that people might see is that we've, for the first time, we've funded a campaign. We don't normally campaign, right? So we're sort of hopefully sober analysts and funders, but we have funded a campaigns unit called Health Equals, which will be active at the party conferences. And that's and the importance of mentioning that is to raise the profile on health inequalities and the fact we can do something about it. But also, secondly, that it's not just the Foundation. There's 26 other collaborating charitable organisations who are also working with us in a consensus way to try to up this agenda and feeding into it. So hopefully you'll see some of that. If it's successful, you will have noticed at the party conferences. If it's less successful, you might not have. But we think that it's important to get a bit antsy on some of this stuff.
Yeah, and also good to hear of the collaboration as well. Very important. Yeah, reference to partners that are working equally hard in this space. Moving back to you, if okay, and just wondering if you can tell us about an event or situation in your career that has been important to your development as someone working in public health.
Yes, thank you. I mean, I think I've probably referred to it actually. For me, it was that pivotal moment at 29 when I went across to America and just had a whole year of breathing space to figure out, having done all this medicine and, you know, worked, was it 96-hour weeks as we did in those days, what just to give some breathing space to think about the future. And that was so profitable, I have to say, as I said before, it was so rich. So I think that was the pivotal moment to development and going on a slightly different course. But it didn't seem risky at the time. It just felt that it was good to be able to follow your nose and to have the freedom to do that for a bit. And I think it's very important that in public health, these spaces are built into the training to allow people to do it with really as much freedom as possible. I mean, it's very easy, isn't it, at the moment, where when anything is funded like a fellowship, that you've got to have impact metrics, people have to come up with. And I do think that's important, but the most important things are intangible and not measurable. So just the space, you know, fund good people, you know, who are thoughtful, give them space and they will do the right thing. I'm a complete, that's old fashioned, I can hear, but it really is the most effective way of helping some people to develop. Some people need rules and they need parameters, but others, particularly those who are selecting themselves to the States, I think may need and want a bit of space. So that for me, I think was the freedom. And then of course, all the opportunities that came afterwards with working in the King's Fund of the Nuffield and here to be able to stretch into new areas and understand their links. And I mean, it's a great privilege. And for me, I could only find that space in the philanthropic world because there aren't really punters in the way that, you know, if I were working for the UKHSA, if I were working for NHS England, if I were working for a university, there'd be students. So you don't have that. There's no external kind of parameters in that way.
I think, yeah, it talks to that, you know, that diversity we mentioned within public health. And for many people, yeah, it's that ability to have that breathing space and to take a step back, sometimes appreciate the complexity, because very little of the work we do is simple cause and effect. So it's good, yeah, good to have that breathing space. I think that ties into the final question we had spoken about. So, you know, career tips for people starting in public health. Did you have a career tip for people starting in public health?
Well, I suppose, I mean, and this probably sounds obvious and people will roll their eyes when they listen. I mean, I think obviously the most important thing is to work hard. And that is like kind of a given, but it sometimes has to be said. Working hard is that's important. I think being reflective as you go along is also critical, not just reflective because you've got a leadership course and that's giving you time, but actually to be constantly reflective of where you're going, what you're doing. And then I think the other thing is that what I see, and I think this is probably sort of common currency these days, is that there is a bit of a race to get the sort of Christmas tree baubles on the tree, by which, and I'm guilty of this, MBA at Stanford or the attachment to the CMO's office or whatever it is. And all that's important and fantastic experience. But I do think it's important, just to continue the analogy, to just take the baubles off the Christmas tree and have a look at the Christmas tree itself. What's under there? What is the basic substrate you've got here with you? Because the baubles are important, but they're add-ons. You need to see what the substance is and try and be true to that as you go forwards, I think. And that includes how you like to work, who you like to work with, what your values are, and so on. And I think only then the baubles become less important as opposed to the most obvious thing that you thrust at people when you meet them.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So understanding why you came into it, what you enjoy, where you can see yourself wanting to work over the next, you know, several decades, and not just those key tags or certificates or, you know, or points of conversation, is it, but that deeper appreciation for the, you know, as you've alluded to throughout, that breadth of what we do and why it's important.
I think so. And sometimes it seems the right thing just to do something sort of off the beaten track. And even though it might not lead to a bauble, for some reason it kind of makes sense later, as everyone says, you live life forwards, but you understand it backwards. And an example for me was that for some reason I don't know quite why I did, but I agreed to be on the board of the Audit Commission, which is this, you know, it's a, now disbanded, of course, like many ALBs, but this is a, you know, the public audit function for local, for the public sector organisations, particularly local government. And I really enjoyed that. I got a lot out of it. But at the time, I remember thinking, why am I doing this? Because it's kind of way off over there somewhere. But now, as I go forwards and I'm thinking about devolution, I'm thinking about what would give government confidence to devolve more powers to local government, where they can act more on, for example, the risk factors for health. Then all of that knowledge of local government and accountability of local government, what I think of Devo, is wrapped up in some of that experience. So it really did make sense, as well as being very enjoyable at the time. So sometimes these little byways that you just if you feel the tug, just try and go for it, as long as it's not too distracting. What I do also see is that sometimes people are grabbing at too much, and they cannot then distinguish a path forwards because everything's exciting. Do you see what I mean? I see that quite a lot. So you have to also be, despite the fact you take a lot of different experiences to go down some byways, it's still important to that it somehow consolidates some. So that's where your reflection comes in about adding meaning to it all and making the next choice count.
And I think a very good summary, that personal individual career advice going forward, speaking to the benefits of a career in public health for the individual and the interest that lies there. And also the start of your answer, talking to the breadth of what you and the Health Foundation are looking at doing, working through, you know, devolution, wider determinants, you know, going back to what we discussed at the beginning. I think, to me, an absolutely perfect example of the breadth of what we do in public health, why it's interesting, why a career in it can be so rewarding.
Been, as you say, it's been really enjoyable, and the podcast, but also public health is, you know, it's been an utter privilege, and it's been completely and utterly rewarding and very changeable as time has gone on. So endlessly fascinating, and I hope to be around for quite some time in the future.
That's really nice. It's good to, good to hear. And yeah, couldn't agree more about endlessly rewarding. It's a good choice, good career. And I think we're lucky to be working in it. Well, thank you for your time. Really do appreciate it.